You see, when we're living in our disease, we're in pain. And we're in pain. There's two levels of pain, two that I distinguish. The deep level and the surface level. On the surface level is not trivial pain. Serious stuff on the surface. Broken bones, divorces, public humiliation, death of loved ones, fatal diseases, on and on. That, you say, you call it the surface? Yeah, it's pain that you know where it's coming from, and it's awful, but there it is. Then there's pain that's kind of dull and deep, and I call that the oceanic ache. That's the pain that goes along with this illness. It's a pain that's caused by the inability to be honest. The inability to be honest in an atmosphere of acceptance and trust. The inability to speak our heart so that we can be healed, so that we can be comforted. And every human being has a deep need to say what's inside and have someone else hear it and look back at us. We need to have that done. We yearn to have that done. If we don't get to do that, we are in isolation. We're in anguish because there's no connection and there's no felt understanding and love. We cannot believe we're loved if the one who supposedly loves us doesn't know our story. They just love an image, you know. They wouldn't love me if they knew. No way. That's by the way the core beliefs of the addict. Read about the sexual compulsive behavior in Out of the Shadows, a book by Patrick Carnes. And he talks about the core beliefs of an addict. That the inside, and it works for, yeah, they're pretty loud outside too. The core beliefs, he said there's four core beliefs and only one of the beliefs has to do with a particular addiction. The first is, basically, I'm no good. Second, if they knew the truth, they'd reject me. They'd never accept me. Third, if I have to wait around for them to help me fulfill my needs, I'd wait forever. I got to take care of things myself. Fourth, control is my most important need. Sex is my most important need. Being sexually attractive is my most important need. A drink is my most important need. A pill is. That will take care, that will give solace. We need solace. We need love. We need to be connected as children of God with one another. We just yearn for that and I've got to have it. And when it's blocked off, we're at an ache. I call the oceanic ache just that dull pain. And that's the kind of pain that puts us in jeopardy of drinking again, of acting again. With that pain, you add one of those surface pains, the death of a spouse, a real setback, you lose your job. And if it's combined with the oceanic ache, we're gone. We'll do something crazy. And when we get in the program, that oceanic ache begins to drain away. We still have all the troubles of life, but it begins to drain away so that once we're really working our surrender and self-acceptance and a faith leads us to start telling the truth in this kind of way that the middle steps lead us to do, and that ache begins to drain away, then all of those surface pains in life change the way they affect us. And we've experienced this already. If somebody dies and you have the oceanic ache, you have a drink because, God, you know, they died. Once we're in the program and that drains away, if somebody dies you love, I've got enough grief and trouble without drinking besides. It sharpens the motivation to be sober and increases our gratitude. And on down the line, lose your job? Well, I lost my job. I don't have much money. Insecure, I'm sure not going to drink besides that and make it worse, you know. So everything is turned, you see. Once that, our heart has the solace it needs, you know. And it's working the middle steps that does that. Working the middle steps that connects us up with God and other human beings so that we have this flow. The flow of recognition, love, understanding, acceptance. And once that's flowing and going on, we become very tough. You know, we're fragile in our own way. But once that's going on, nobody can take it away from you. Nobody can get you drunk, and nobody can get you to panic and live in control again. They just can't. Because the more pressure brought to bear, once the program's in place, the more motivation to work the program. It just locks in, you know. So we begin to do this stuff, you know. It occurred to me the other day, you know, I love paradox, as you probably are noticing. Someone was extolling honesty, you know. And I think I might have mentioned this in the opening night here. But when we actually practice honesty, it's not a smooth deal, you know. We still have our fear affecting us. You know? And we're not so sure about this. And there's a certain amount, there's a certain despair and sense of failure, even a sense of death in being honest. Because as we get honest, the old self dies. The old image bites the dust. You can't keep up the old front when you're talking against the old front. You know, oh my gosh. But it makes us feel disoriented, you know. What'll I do with get the new image, you know. And as we try it out and tell the truth, of course the instant the connection's made, oh, then the anguish is over about losing our image and that kind of thing. The other thing about the way the fourth and fifth step is constructed, it'll sound, when we still have some fear affecting the way we read and understand, and we read made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Okay. If you hear it in that tone of voice, it seems like this is going to be kind of a guilty kind of trip here. There's the vibrations of blame going on there. We're going to have to write down everything that's our fault. What's your fault? What do you deserve blame for? And if you start doing an inventory with the attitude that I've got to write down the things I deserve blame for, and sometimes it'll stop you in your tracks. It's very depressing to write down things you deserve blame for. And then you could, because when we're in fear, that's a fear word, blame. And when we're in fear, we do one of two things with stuff that could be in our inventory. We either justify ourselves, make a case, make a little defense attorney before God. Well, it wasn't really so bad. I mean, if your parents were like my parents, you probably would have done worse. It is a free country. I mean, it's not against the law, after all. Free consenting adults. We'll make a case, okay. And then if we're not making a case for ourselves when we're in fear, we will go over to the other side and just have utter contempt for ourselves. Just say, you lowlife, you are just disgusting. I mean, not only are you immoral, you're immoral in bad taste. There's no hope for you. You know? And you know, but you go into a self-disgusting. That added, all of that stuff is the way, is an attitude of fear. And when we take when we start doing our inventory and writing down resentments, when we write down a resentment, we're not writing down stuff we deserve blame for. There's no one around blaming us. We write down stuff that we need healing for, that we need liberation about. We write down stuff where it hurts, where we have hurt them and we have hurt ourselves by hurting, and where we need some healing. Nobody's after us. And we have a higher power who loves us and treasures us. And when we have contempt for ourselves, that interferes with our relationship with God because it's not in harmony with our higher power's attitude. Higher power has compassion and acceptance in the same way any decent member of the fellowship has when you're talking to him. If you're pouring out what's inside of you, you don't have to be the world champion Avalon or AA member. All they have to be is just a regular attending the meetings person. You know? And with full of their own fears and freak out feelings and so forth. And if you start telling them what's on your mind, they're vastly relieved you're not as good as they thought. Because now they're probably going to be able to be honest with you. They receive you with, there's no, you did what? You know, this, well, you know, has anyone ever in a participation meeting, someone got up and talked about abandoning their family in the Midwest and fleeing out here? Say, well, you know, there's consequences of that. I'm afraid we'll have to whip you. Mm-hmm. Up to every member of the group gets 5 lashes to pay the price. You know, that's not our business. That's not. It's on the other hand, the group doesn't pat somebody on the head and say, "Oh, poor baby." They probably were too demanding on you anyway. There's a respect for a person. It looks like you got some amends to make and some healing to go through, and we're going to stand by you while you do what's got to be done for healing. And once, you see, at that attitude, there's no reason to be defensive and make excuses, and there's no reason to despise yourself. Either one. Fear is the whole foundation of excuses and self-contempt. And once we get into the spirit of the program, it's putting down what we have to say because we need healing there. And when we take responsibility, you know, when somebody hurt us, you know, the big book says we don't dwell on the other person's inventory, what they've done wrong. If people have done wrong to you, there's never any reason to pretend they didn't. The other person and judge them with rejecting judgment, which doesn't hurt anybody, which doesn't help anybody. But to acknowledge, that's a lot of the healing in ACA, is to get it straight. What happened and how I had a need to pretend I wasn't hurt in order to survive at the time. We get that straightened out. But if we're working the program and the steps, we'll keep moving ahead. And as we acknowledge that, we acknowledge, and you say, what do you mean our part? When you're a little kid, you know, you're going to blame yourself for being negative after they beat you up. You're going to blame yourself for being an iceberg and distant after you were sexually abused. You know, why do that? It's their fault. Fear. That's fear talking. There's no healing going on there. I have a little list of things that, you see, the thing is, when we write down our inventory, our part in the transaction, we're not writing down what we deserve blame for. There's no deserved blame left. There's only a searching for healing and integral that we cannot be healed unless we take responsibility for our lives. So we own our own feelings and own what we do and kind of stand up with the trust that we're accepted in this group by God and other people, and people will help us walk through and get free of the ways we've handled things. For example, it can be something that isn't a sin or at all. You're abused. You were the one they hurt. What should you put in your inventory? Well, acknowledge you've been hurt as best you can, but then acknowledging your own part. We might say, I acknowledge that I burdened others with the obligation of making me happy. I just decided that they had to treat me right, or I would never be happy, and it's their fault. Nobody can make us happy. One of the ways we can tell we've assigned someone else the job of making us happy is when we're very deeply disappointed or resentful of the other person. We're holding it against them. God damn it. That person hurt you. That isn't funny. But you acknowledge your hurt and reach, okay, what does a person do after they're hurt that way? Well, they have to acknowledge it. Maybe they have to even tell the person. But we don't have to get them to apologize or change. And we don't have to roll back history and have it not happen. The program says, nobody can stop you from working your program and having a life. And we don't have to have rejecting judgment on anyone else. And we're not in the business of getting blameworthy stuff for ourselves. But to say, I'll combine this too. I kind of made a distinction. Maybe they can emerge. But the number two was, we acknowledge that we mess back when they mess with us. You say, well, why should I even mention that? That's so little, you know. I mean, the way I was treated, hardly blame anybody for being distant and negative. Nobody's blaming. But if you are distant and negative as a way of coping and avoiding hurt, you have hurt yourself a lot. And you're in the habit of hurting yourself a lot. And if you can say that's what you're doing, you're one step closer to being set free from that behavior. It's nothing to do with blaming you. That's the way an inventory heals. Also good to acknowledge resentments we have against God. I resented God for two reasons. I resented Him for not making me turn out better. And I resented Him for not giving me a bigger payoff for my compliance. No. I went to the seminary early and I was a good boy. Now, you know, make me good and make me, you know, let's reward. It's a self-centered kind of attitude. Nobody's blaming me and putting me down for being kind of mad at God for not making me turn out better. That's what happens if you get a basic misunderstanding about what the deal is with God, you know. I thought the deal was, you know, that I'd get over everything and finally be all right and have everybody look up to me forever. You can see how this is it's the very heart of this is transformation. It's a woman, very touching to me, this story of a gal who heard this in a pitch, 10-minute pitch. She gave it at a convention. I don't remember the long pitch at all, but her sharing really knocked me out. And in this very brief sharing, she talked about getting sober, and then once she got a little stabilized and started getting in the program, talking to a sponsor, she talked about the way she resented her father. She said, my father was so bad. He was so cruel and he abused me so much that no way, I mean, me, drop, he's this bastard. You know? And the sponsor said, ask God to help you let it go. And she wouldn't even cooperate with that for a little while. Then finally, with the negative feelings of that, well, okay, I'll give it a shot. So she said, okay, I'll let go of the resentment. Then it didn't go. Stuck. Then she said, well, I guess you're going to have to pray for him. pray for him? So the big book suggests we pray for somebody. So she prayed for him. The resentment stayed. Pray for him as you would a sick friend. Prayed, still resented it. The sponsor said, okay, after a few more months of that, you'll have to escalate this to the next stage. You know, what is that? You're going to have to treat him decently. Oh, no, not that. He lived in the same town still. And he was in contact with the family. And she'd see him once in a while. Couldn't avoid it. She saw everybody else. She says, you don't have to pretend you like him. You don't just treat him decently. Don't put out negative stuff. If you find it very difficult, but at least be civil and do things decent to him. She'd already done her foot. I think she said to him that, you know, she was hurt. And they didn't work. You know, I mean, he didn't respond very well. Okay, so she went on the, okay, under the heading of treating him decently meant sending him a birthday card, Christmas card, and saying hello when she met him. So she did that for about 4 years and felt a resentment still. He finally got sick and went to the hospital for some surgery or other. And he was in the hospital, and she thought, well, under the heading of treating him decent, I guess that means I have to go by with a card or a flower or something. And so she went by and did her duty, walked in, put the thing down, said hello, hope it get better, without much feeling, and went down, and she said she was getting into her car and realized the resentment was gone. She was in touch with his humanity at last. And was no longer under the oppression of his own illness. Her father was sick and couldn't love and lashed out in ways that were awful. But she was set free from his illness by working this program. It's not that we let people off the hook and mollify and say, oh, it wasn't so bad. Nothing to do with that. It's cooperating with God to set us free from other people's emotional domination of our lives by keeping us negative. You see how different this is? This is prayerful. This is honest. This requires an atmosphere in which we are given assurance that we're not blamed and rejected. And that it isn't even to our interest to find out we're innocent. You know? You don't get any points for being innocent. You don't get any points for saving God the trouble of healing you. You don't get any. It's just a matter of getting to the truth. Getting to what in us is causing us to snuff out life. What in us is walling me off from being in touch with the humanity of somebody. What in me is preventing me. What in me and my attitude and memories and things I'm holding makes me still vulnerable to the cruelty of another person who lives far away, you know, or I'm still churning about them. And the big book says, we have a program that'll give you healing from that. And it doesn't come at our time and just the way we want to. Sometimes it'll be 5 years, even while we're applying ourselves steadily. But you know that person, that woman who did that thing with her father, if she did that for 5 years, she's working a hell of a program, you know. And she was still bedeviled by that, and it was still kind of a pain. But still she was going in the direction. You know? And the whole thing is not the result, but that we go in the right direction. Sex relationships are a good field for just mentioning how the transformation is the big thing, the transformation of attitude from defensiveness, fear, and self-contempt, you know, over to faith. Because when we're, do the sex inventory or relationship inventory, where there's the things we look at, I find that being a Catholic and being a professional Catholic, I studied morality rather closely. I got down to every... I probably know the names of more sins than you do. I know all kinds of ways of sin. And the big book, when it does gives a couple pages of commentary on making an inventory in our lives in the sex area, it says we treat sex as we would any other issue, any other problem. And we treat relationships that are sexual in nature kind of the way we treat other relationships. In other words, what we ask is, how have I hurt others or hurt myself? Rather than, what gradation of sin did I commit and how much danger am I in? You know, which could be the self-centered, pious person's thing of getting obsessed with my standing and how guilty I am or not, which is a very unloving thing, you know. It's a very inconsiderate thing. And the big book's a good guide for that. Just a few comments on different aspects of relationship. One, a marriage relationship. You know, the most god-awful surrender is necessary for two people to be able to stand each other in close quarters. I'll never forget the talking to several couples in a row on a couples retreat. The first retreat I ever did, it's an annual thing, and a lot of the couples keep coming back, and these are not young couples. They are not couples with unstable marriages. It started out with a doctor and his wife, and it was a bunch of other doctors, 7 doctors and their wives, as they call it. And then over the years, they were added and changed, but there were a few of the originals. One year, third or fourth year into doing this, several couples came in to talk to me, and they were married in an average of 35 years, and weren't talking about divorce or separation. That wasn't the issue. They had something in their relationship they wanted to discuss, and that was, well, they were stable. You know, they were sober, long-term members of the program. And after I talked to 3 couples in a row of long-term successful marriages, I was in awe at the depth of pain in a happy marriage. Jean Vanier, a spiritual writer that I admire a lot. He's living. He's a Frenchman who started all this chain of resonances for developmentally disabled people. Very spiritual guy, and he wrote a thing on sex and marriage. And one of his things, comments about marriage, he says, the special mode of married love is forgiveness. Doesn't mean you do a bad program and let someone walk all over you, be a doormat. No. It's just continuous forgiveness is necessary to keep the ship afloat. I think a happy marriage is one in which the husband and wife love each other, are glad they're married to each other, but really miss each other if they were separated and can barely stand each other. There's just something about a person who refuses to get out of your face, you know? They won't go home. It's because they are home. And the surrender of letting another person be, I think that surrender can be expressed in the mode of forgiveness a lot. Forgiving them just for being there. Forgiving them for... forgiving them for the way they won't wise up ever. You know, forgive is forgiveness. You can say anything you want, be honest, but there's an element of a decision. You know, we kind of have the We have a choice of whether or not to forgive the person's presence. And you forgive their presence and forgive this and forgive that. And you can be honest. Say anything you want. Make your complaints and turn over the results of the complaint. And, of course, the thing I mentioned earlier, what happens when we do totally forgive and turn over, and that is the goodness of that person becomes available to us again. And there can be some fun, you know. But that's... And so in an inventory, there can be, especially from the Al-Anon point of view, it's very difficult. I think it's much harder for an Al-Anon to take an inventory, even though we alcoholics can't remember half of what we did. It's hard because there's so much injury done unto a person who comes to Al-Anon. As such horrendous inconsideration, you know, and insensitive, boorish, overbearing betrayals and everything. And I'm getting into it, right? Yeah. Of course, it takes, you know, getting into the program, you know, to make the distinction between not being a doormat and standing up for yourself, and while standing up for oneself and being honest, to forgive. That's a distinction we can make well only when we're surrounded by people working the program. We need a lot of support to kind of understand. And so when we put in our inventory, I didn't forgive a lot. Because I, you know, and again, we say, I didn't forgive this person who's hurting me. That's not my fault. No one says it's your fault. No one's blaming you. But if you get into the habit of having hardness of heart and protecting yourself by being tough in that manner, well, then you just get a little too tough. A little too tough for your own good. And you just get so tough that there's no comfort can get through the defense to touch your heart and be of solace. So we write down, didn't harden, held things against them and was cold and distant. That doesn't mean you're taking the blame, because there's no blame. It's funny, you know, in the boyfriend-girlfriend, or boyfriend-boyfriend, girlfriend-girlfriend relationships, an aspect of the courting or the going out with somebody that kind of tickles me, but it's funny, but it's tragic, is there seems to be social permission to lie and deceive and manipulate anybody that you have a chance of having a sexual relationship with. And you're supposed to be honest and considerate and respectful of everybody else. But if there's a chance, you're kind of allowed to lie in order to make a good impression. So it'll work. And, you know, do we? You know, there's something about the social permission. And I think that has to be kind of looked at. The... and I think, you know, in relationships that have some social stigma connected, there's a mild stigma, I guess, connected with living one another without being married. Stigma connected with gay relationships. And whenever there's a little bit of a social stigma, it adds a lot to defensiveness. There's a thing, well, it's not wrong. Well, if someone is accusing us, then we tend to get defensive. And one thing about the program of 12 steps leads us always to a point where we don't have to be defensive, where we can honestly just, God, please help me see what I'm really up to and really doing and what my intentions are, and let me know if I'm hurting myself or others. Because nobody's really blaming us. And so I think when it comes to relationships, say long-term relationships that are irregular in some way by society standards, there's still, in our inventory, we look, what's the bottom line here? Not what do they say, How am I experiencing this? What do I say? What's my own conscience? And I think a guide to examining a relationship that's sexual is to take out the sex and say, how do you treat the person as a person if you disregard the sex altogether? And that tells us how we're treating a person as a person. There's a necessity of radical surrender, of being willing for a person to either love us or not love us, or make a decision to go where they want to go or not, where you are honest about what you'd like, but you have to let the person, grant them their freedom, or we manipulate and don't treat a person right. It's not good manners. It backfires. The transformation that the program offers us is especially apparent in behavior that we would kind of all, that most people agree is, pretty destructive. Behavior that's in the sexual area that's, I'd say, very promiscuous behavior, where there's a lot of sex that's really impersonal practically, or the kind of behavior that goes along with drinking a lot, you know. And we can say, if there's fear, there's either a bunch of excuses or utter shame and contempt. And if there's faith, there's the attitude that, you know, if you have sex with a lot of different people and you're not ready, you sure have to lie a lot. And there's something about sex where there's a God-givenness to the whole operation, where it seems there's a sort of a built-in message. And two people can be agreed that they're not, this is no big deal, this isn't the answer, we're not going to be a couple. But just after I bought you dinner, though. and for God's sake. And there may be an agreement that there's, you know, I'll mention this. But there's a certain, like, nature, there's a certain given about the message of sexual intercourse. And the given is just, it is a symbolic way of saying, we're in this together. And I care about your whole life, and I kind of care where your laundry is done and what your plans are and how your taxes are doing. And it implicitly says that. You didn't realize that, but implicitly. And when the endocrine system gets secreting certain little chemical messages that go out to the body, and the whole body gets ready to have some security and have some place to rest your head where they don't move fast and drop it. There's a, and whether there's, it doesn't matter whether anybody means this or not. The whole system gets ready for some kind of intimacy and love and tenderness. And then when it doesn't happen, it's like getting your chin dropped on cement. And so it's tough. And if a person looks at their own life, say, with insufficient preparation or whatever, wasn't personal enough, and says, you know, there was some damage to me and other people, and I want to acknowledge that. No defensiveness, no contempt for oneself. See, in a faith it can be that way, and then we can talk in a way that's healing and not just circular, you know. We started a little late, and I went a little late. I should stop. Usually I stop just before I say anything about sex and get... But I didn't get to the perversions. I had a whole page on perversions, but I don't. Come back next time. Let's pray. Let's see. We pray the Lord's Prayer, then we have the meeting is scheduled at 9.
I don't know.
Do we have a meeting? 8:45. Let's say 9 o'clock. Let's say 9. Let's stand and pray the Lord's Prayer.
This is the end of session 4 and the start of session 5.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. My original plan this morning was to have a reflection on the 11th step, which I'm still going to do, and then lead into a meditation that would be a silent meditation, basically, where everybody would go out in the sunshine and walk around. And so I think we're a little bit cooped up here, so we'll probably have a guided meditation for a little while right where we're sitting. Pretty high. We'll have to get a microphone here next year or something. The 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. This is the step where we cooperate with our higher power to energize, let grow the spiritual awakening He's bringing about within us. The thing about prayer is not that we need to remind God of anything or kind of get Him on our side or give Him instructions or show how good we are. It's nothing and this is not something like some modern reflection, as if I am saying, dun, 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 the 20th century, we know now that we're not the one that cajole God into doing things. This is standard spiritual wisdom. St. Augustine in the 5th century had long essays on how our prayers aren't meant to change God at all. Our prayers simply change us so that our hearts are more open to the action. The God's favor, God's love, His way is on. His love is out there. Healing and forgiveness, and that's flowing like a river. That's going on. The only variable in the whole thing is what's inside of us. The only variable is whether I can catch it or not. And if I'm drinking and distracted, when I have a lot of I gottas, I gotta have this, gotta have that, when I got the gottas, I am single-mindedly paying attention to what I figure I need in the way and when I need it, and I simply miss what my higher power has in mind. It just kind of sails by. Could have got it, but I'm not paying attention to that. I got my hands full. And in our desperation for survival, we kind of do that. And after we begin to have a spiritual awakening and we're drawn into the fellowship, and we kind of get wised up a bit, and we have our heart healed a bit, and we have some people start to know us as we are, and we start to have some exchange, and it's this wonderful relief where you don't have to put up any pretense. We put it up anyway, just in case. But we can devote less energy to the pretense. And we start letting this spiritual touch, the awakening, have a big effect in our life and guide us. Well, even then, we're in a world with a lot of competing voices. I started out the retreat by talking about how recovery itself can take the shine off of our spiritual awakening by distracting us into all of the advance and the job we're doing and the comparing how well I'm doing. And it goes on and on. There is at the risk of making this tape unable to be sent through the mails. I think that this is just, you know, like for educational purposes only. I have to use this word in order to get across the kind of distraction which I think is one of the biggest obstacles to letting our spiritual awakening continue to nourish and guide us. The way this was described, it's unforgettable to me. There's a guy, I go to my main home meeting is the White Flag Men's Stag, downtown Los Angeles. One of the guys came in one night and he was just saying, "Oh, I've been listening to K-Fuck all day." I'm sorry if that's what he said, and everybody knew what he meant. You know? Everybody knew that there's a running commentary of self-obsessed fear in the back of our heads. Just this running commentary on how bad everyone else is doing and how unfair life is and how things we probably... He's leaving. And there's great competition for computer time, you might call it. The great competition, who gets on the screen? You know, there's lots of people waiting in line to get on your screen. Self-obsessed fear, regular talk radio, the kids, all kind of competing influences and so forth. And they all want, they're waiting their turn to get on the screen. And maybe two or three at once are on the screen, so you're kind of looking like this. And prayer has to do with deliberately tuning in to your own spiritual awakening, tuning in to your higher power and the basis of our own experience of a higher power, so that we're not swept away by listening to that radio station where it just fills our life with negativity and a thing that drains us instead of nourishes us. And as we, well, how do you do that? How do you tune in? Well, we start to meditate. We listen to God. Well, how do you listen to God? I want to suggest that everybody here has a lot of experience and we're fairly practiced at listening to God. Anybody who's been to meetings on any kind of a regular basis has gotten used to a certain spiritual discipline, a routine. And I call it kind of an active meditation. And when we do that, we simply at a meeting, and somebody starts to share their experience, strength, and hope. And as they're telling their story or going through what they're going to go through, and it's, you know, in a significant percentage of the time, somebody who is sharing their experience, strength, and hope is doing so in a way that we can relate to. And they're doing so in a way where they talk about their life and what happened in terms of the spiritual awakening they had. Now, they may not mention the word God, and they may not mention the word spiritual awakening at all. Probably won't. But they'll simply tell their story. And in the story, if there's a turn in their life where it was from struggling and being negative and despair and total frustration into finding a big relief, where they were drawn into this pathway where instead of trying, fighting yourself, there was a turn and a peacefulness where we just kind of relax and someone holds your hand while you get used to being a dingbat alky. And then they give you some suggestions on footwork that makes you more peaceful with that, and then give you suggestions that increase the quality of our spiritual hygiene. You know, instead of constantly hiding, we actually can connect with another person. Instead of being so drained and taken up with our self-obsession, we're drawn out of ourselves to pay attention to somebody else and then find the relief and the freshening up and the relaxation that comes from being let off the hook where I can actually pay attention to another human being. And instead, all those things that start to happen, and then the discovery that we're sober and we don't mind it. I'm sober and I don't feel like I'm doing some big heroic thing. I feel like I'm just fortunate that I get to be clean and sober. I don't have to go through all that exhausting, draining, isolating. Oh, thank you, God. That's a spiritual awakening, by the way, if you don't even think of God directly, but it's rather indirectly. And if you're listening to somebody's pitch, and be it AA or Al-Anon, and somebody starts talking about the surprising liberation of do a little workout of release with love. Okay, I release you. I heard one Al-Anon woman one time, and it was suggested to her that she give her husband permission to drink. And it was meant, inside, let go, don't resist the thing. But she walked in and says, I give you permission to drink. And he said, but it was part of her spiritual awakening. She did it. It confused him to no end. He didn't know what was going on for a while. But when we listen to these, to the stories of our brothers and sisters, and in the middle of the story you say, oh, yeah, uh-huh, yeah, you're meditating. You're listening to God. Now, wait a minute. That person isn't God there. This is what I mean. When we identify with the spiritual awakening of another, if someone else's spiritual awakening, and I listen to it, and it rings my bell, if it resonates with the experience I've had, then the experience I've had comes to life. It's raised up on my screen. It has the center. And as, when it's raised up on my screen, it becomes a more vital thing within me. And then I relate that past event to today. And it has an effect of giving more hope for today and more encouragement to live in the spirit of that past experience. In other words, I'm listening to God. I'm listening to the voice of God that hit me already and that then speaks to me afresh about today, and I get encouragement and direction. See? You're all good at it already. You're all good at meditation. And when we meditate, we do something like that all the time. You use a 24-hour-a-day book, you use another book, and what you're doing is reading something that's a reflection or a report or a reflection on or the result of a spiritual experience of somebody. And if you read the report of someone else's spiritual experience, and if it rings your bell, if you identify it all, there's that thing happens. And as the thing happens, it becomes available to me. And that process goes on, and we listen to God. We can do that in a meeting. We can do that out of a little book. We can do that. There are many forms of doing it. One of the a form of meditation that we usually associate with Eastern religions, Buddhism, or more of a transcendental meditation, is emptying out. By the way, that form of meditation was very common among Christians before the printing press. Since the printing press, we got so much paper. We're reading all the time. And we won't shut up. If we shut up, we'll read. We won't just quiet down and just be in the presence of our higher power with less activity. And so it's that tradition was kind of lost. At least it was thinned out, And I think there are some mantras. I use this, I consider them more Al-Anon mantras. They seem to have the best ones. I don't know how many A ones. But release with love or release. Let Go. These are my two favorite ones. And all by themselves, they wouldn't mean anything to somebody, you know? Release or Let Go. But if you've been in the program for a while, then we've had 10,000 hours of conversation and reflection on the whole way of life that involves releasing and letting go. To simply say in a meditation with no book or anything else, just sit there and say, release. And then when your radio station is coming in, just say, release. Release. What you're saying is, I want to be quiet in the presence of my higher power. Release. I want to be present in the presence of the spiritual awakening my higher power has been giving me. That isn't, I don't have access to it all the time a lot. And I'm so full of today's stuff and my own fears and all of this that I need my higher power to kind of barge into me. And I want to cooperate with this empty, giving a little landing space. You know, just quiet down and give a landing space. And it takes a lot of trust to do that. It means you believe in God if you do that. Because it doesn't make any sense to make an empty space if there's nothing to come in. Just release or let go. Or you make up your own one, you know, something that suggests the whole program to you or suggests some special understanding you have. And just be quiet. But this, you know, if we don't have time, if we don't take time to just give our spiritual awakening a chance to come up on the screen, well, you know what happens to people who don't go to meetings and don't pray? They get very preoccupied with things. And it's a if we think of this in terms of fear, the usual way we think in terms of things, of being a little bad girl or a good girl, that's fear. Of being a good girl who prays and meditates, very good. Or bad, never doing that. And then so you get a little star if you pray, and you get a black mark if you don't pray. When we think in those terms, prayer will always be a chore and a sign of being under the thumb and oppressed by rules.